Creative expression through the exploration of materials, including ceramics glazed with peanut butter and guacamole. Stay tuned. You are tuned in to a segment of Issues and Ideas called Ears on Art, which is produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio KCBX, serving the Central California coast from Ventura to Salinas. I am Stephen DeLuque, and today and next week, co-host Krissa Hewitt and I have a conversation with artist Rick Vanini and his wife Kathy. Rick has had extensive experience in the art world and has explored many different styles and mediums. He is currently working on a 3-volume set of his collage works titled Cardboard Jungle, but more about that in next week's program. Now, let's meet Rick and Kathy Vanini.
Stephen and I are here in Atascadero with Rick and Kathy, and I'm going to let you say your last name because I loved how it rolled off your tongue.
Vanini.
See, I knew he could do it better than I could. This is one of those fun times where you actually sent something to us to say, have you seen any of my work? And unfortunately, I had not. Had you?
I had not before either.
So, you get great surprises sometimes in this world of email and communication. So, thank you for reaching out. We'll be talking about your work quite a bit, but let's kind of talk about how art started for you.
Well, ever since I was a young boy, I've always had some type of artistic talent, whether it was drawing cartoons for my mom or making stuff around the house. So it kind of came naturally to me. But it wasn't until I moved out to California in the 80s where I really decided to focus that it was going to be my career, much to the dismay of my parents, I might add.
So was your mother in need of a laugh, or was she the one that got the cartoons?
Both of my brothers and my mother and father were the recipients of my cartoons. Yeah, I would tape them to their desks or stuff like that. Drawings from my mother were usually a knight rescuing a maiden. You know, she seemed to appreciate that type of chivalry. Then, you know, it just kind of went on from there. I mean, I've always had a serious artistic streak. You know, I was born in Europe and I grew up in Greece for 4 years, so I was really exposed to a lot of the classical art in society, and it just got me kind of interested because I knew it was important to societies. You know, I was only probably 10 years old, but when you go into a museum and you see these gold mask of Midas or some Greek antiquities, you realize that art sticks around through the centuries, and I wanted to be a part of that, frankly.
Well, that certainly makes sense. I guess maybe deep inside we all want to leave our mark in some way.
Yeah, I think it's every artist's dream to have that your work carries on beyond you.
Which perhaps sounds rather conceited, but I think it's more just maybe all of us want something of ourselves to live beyond.
I think also maybe just to be a one of, to be a part of something. I think all humans deep down want to be a part of something. You know, it's not a bad thing to be a part of the art world.
So you were drawing, painting. Were you teaching yourself? Were you going to school, learning any of this? What's some of that background?
I'm essentially self-taught. However, I did take some college classes. I studied under Joe Hisong in the Monterey Peninsula College, and he was studied under Hamada, the national treasure, and I got a lot of good, serious guidance from him as far as, you know, what real art represents and, you know, some of the sensibilities of Asian art, believe it or not, and sometimes less is more. And he just taught me really important lessons about art. And unfortunately, he's no longer with us, but, you know, what he taught me stayed with me for a long time.
This was ceramics.
Yes.
This has nothing to do with any of his paintings or collage.
I would bet that that isn't quite the case if everything kind of folds into something else. But yes, and so working in clay, were you throwing, were you working sculpturally, some of both?
Well, a little of everything. I was a lab assistant there for 3 years, so I was working, firing everyone else's art and giving guidance and that, and pretty much being his assistant. But while I was there, I made lots of pottery I learned how to throw. I studied under a master. He wouldn't have let me be his assistant had I not known those things. Yeah.
I was more curious a direction or an interest that that took, since clay has such versatility to it.
It did in a way, and then once again, I was working as a painter at the same time. I adhere to a philosophy that was actually developed by a musician called Frank Zappa, and it's called conceptual continuity, where everything you do should be somehow intertwined with everything else you do to create a kind of a fabric of who you are and your art and your creativity, and that's what I've tried to do. So in that sense, the ceramics does tie in to my career as an artist, but not to the degree where one would think. It was just something that I wanted to learn, master, and move on.
Yeah, there's a lot of versatility in our lives often, and you can't stick with all of them or you'd probably get nothing done.
Yeah.
But I also find it interesting to talk with people who have really explored more than one medium, and often more than one medium, both in your case now, a three-dimensional and a two-dimensional, and how that connection works for you?
Well, there is, because if you'll notice, some of my cardboard jungle pieces have a great three-dimensional quality to them, despite them being a two-dimensional piece. And you learn little tricks like that, and that's actually an excellent observation. I try to make my cardboard jungle pieces as three-dimensional as possible, my collage pieces as three-dimensional as possible. And I think, I don't know, maybe that ties in somehow. I don't know.
We'll get back to the cardboard jungle, but just to make sure that people have a little sense of this, it is not a three-dimensional construct in the sense of making a jungle out of cardboard, but it is a wonderful series of collage works, and that are cardboard is the backing, right?
Yes.
Okay. That's the simple version.
I was just going to say I did the same thing with printmaking. I went heavily into printmaking for 5 or 6 years, and then I just walked away and did something else, and I've never been back. But you learn an awful lot learning the processes.
Absolutely.
and the discipline it takes.
It's a life experience that really adds, you know, it's just one little thing, you know, that you could go back and say, yeah, well, you see that vase over there? I made that back, you know, before I was a painter or whatever, or while I was a painter. It's just one of those things. I wanted to be a well-rounded artist and not someone who is just, you know, one-dimensional and just a painter or something. I wanted to, just like you said, Stephen, I wanted a life experience.
The painting, and there we see several of them as we sit in your living room, what kinds of things started to interest you?
One of the things Joe Heisong taught me, my ceramics instructor at MPC, was to experiment. He said, never be scared to try new things. A quick story is when he caught me smearing peanut butter on a greenware plate and putting it in the kiln, and he asked me, well, you know, have you lost your mind? And I said, well, peanut butter has salt in it, doesn't it? And oil. I mean, aren't those two key ingredients for glazes? And he looked at me for a second, and I'm just going to move on to the end part of the story, but the next day he arrived at the studio with about 5 or 6 bags of groceries, and he was grinding up Doritos and everything else, and we made glazes with food, and it's little things like that. So, like, for instance, this painting right here that you're, unfortunately, we can't see because it's radio, that's an experimental piece that I was quite happy with. What that is spray paint, you know, just basic spray paint that you can buy at Home Depot. But it's moved around the canvas with my homemade brushes that I've made out of cardboard. And I've made the edges different patterns and stuff like that. And I got this idea by watching a street person in San Francisco making art for tourists with spray paint, spray cans, and he was using hairbrushes and combs to move this stuff around, and I was fascinated with it. It was really immediate and fascinating art. So I decided to give it a shot. I've had a lot of fun with it, and I'm still doing it, actually. I kind of took a break to finish my books here, but...
Okay, so I've sprayed, in essence, a puddle of paint mm-hmm. on a surface that just doesn't absorb that fast, so then I can get in with something and smear it around. I suppose more of us have experienced that by having things drip with spray paint. Ah, Kathy's brought out another one.
This one's before the collage was added.
you can see kind of this texture from the moving around of the brushes and combs and everything. And if you scrape away before it's dried, you get what's underneath. And you really get some interesting patterns. It's just another technique, another experiment. You know, you got to always be able to risk stuff. Otherwise, you'll never discover anything new and exciting. You always got to be able to take chances. And, you know, believe it or not, I've had some success with them. Some people less than enthusiastic about them. And some people were really great with them. I did a charity thing for Art Gem, the United Way, where I made pieces right there in front of people. I had a little crowd around me. They were fascinated by it. I told them to be careful for the fumes. I was wearing my respirator, but they didn't seem to mind. And a couple of them were auctioned off right there and actually did well. So, yeah.
I have to go back to the food and the clay. What kind of success rate did you have in terms of interesting solutions?
Well, we had an excellent results. They were, however, you know, when people think of glazes, they think of a glass covering the ceramics completely. These were more ornamental, where it would kind of a burnt pattern. It's not something that you'd want to, you know, serve any your guests with. But it had an interesting scorching pattern. You could, of course, you know, depending on the artist himself and the pattern that they made, it was interesting. It was enough to where Heislong experimented with it for the last few months of his career.
Were you putting down an initial glaze and then doing this on top, or was it on the straight on the clay, or both?
We would mix a little bit, thing like I'd mix guacamole with with some talc and silica, and we were kind of mad scientists there for a while. The lab smelt great, I gotta say. It smelled like we were cooking fajitas back there. No, he really enjoyed it, and he remarked that for the first time in his, like, I think 45, 50-year career as an artist, that he had felt rejuvenated again because he had been kind of reduced to a professor, you know, just blah, blah, blah. In fact, I used to equate him with the sergeant in Beetle Bailey, you know, when I first met him. And then as I got to know him, I realized that I was working with a guy that had just decided to teach instead of be the genius that he was, because he was truly a genius. The National Treasure of Japan doesn't come to study with you and work with you unless you know your stuff. And he did. So he was a very big part of my life.
It's wonderful to have mentors and people like that, of that kind of inspiration. I'm laughing at the cooking odors and so forth because I had students working on a project that hangs in the Cal Poly Library. And we were doing a patina on the copper and using peanut oil that we would brush on and then heat. And that retarded the amount of instant oxidation that was happening and allowed colors to develop. But, of course, it also gave us a nice smell. So the piece ended up being called, kind of nicknamed initially, and then we just left it with that, of being called Popcorn Fantasy. There was nothing in it that looked like popcorn, but... That was what the lab smelled like after a while. So
delicious.
Exactly.
If you have just tuned in, you are listening to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas produced at the studios of KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo, California. Today's guest is Rick Vanini, an artist that has explored a number of different styles and mediums.
And there's some other styles here. Are these your work or...
Most of the art you see in here is mine, with the exception of these two pieces up there, the snakes that belong to my wife, my little budding artist. She's actually a lot better than she admits to be. But the rest of it's pretty much mine. It's stacked everywhere. I have too much.
Well, what I'm referencing here is the ones that we were talking about with the spray paint are a very non-objective, wonderful pattern and color, and then I can look around the room and see other pieces that are quite, quote, recognizable objects. So there's quite a bit of versatility in what you're exploring?
Well, I've been an artist for 35 years. I wanted to tell myself that I want to be able to create something that somebody can recognize as, well, he does have talent. So I went through this phase of doing, you know, lots of florals and seascapes and just to show that I can do it. And then I quickly bailed on it because it's not very exciting to me. I'm more of an expressionist. In fact, my friend Leo Bokel jokingly refers to me as the father of meta-expressionism because it's a funny term, but, you know, because I'm interested in expressing myself in so many different mediums. And, you know, it's just the way I am.
Prolifically, I might add.
Yeah, too much so sometimes.
Kind of a nice variation on Renaissance, I suppose. Mm.
Well, look around this room.
Right.
You see I have varied interests. You'll see all sorts of stuff. African art, Asian art, everything.
I think the message kind of dictates the medium, depending on what you want to say. It picks its own medium.
You couldn't be more correct. When I was driving across the country when I was a young man, I only had a sketchbook with me, and you really can't do abstracts on the road. So I did little scenes of the canvas landscapes and stuff like that, just with black and white. You're right. Whatever it takes and whatever it requires to get the vision out in your head, and I have, you know, so many different ones that it's sometimes hard to concentrate. So I have to, that's why I work in chunks, to be honest with you. Like now that I'm through with this stuff that I've been working on, I have this new project that I'm going to make those mini, I don't know if you remember these. I think it was, who was it? A surrealist who made these mini traveling briefcases that had his shows in them. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make these miniature traveling Vanini shows that people can buy and take home and enjoy.
So do you work in series?
I do. And that's a very good question. And I think you probably picked that up just by glancing at those books over there. I do work in series. I tend to have so much to say that it requires more than one piece. I've done a series as high as 40 paintings of the same idea. Just each one's a little different. So, yes, I love working in series. I love doing clumps of paintings that all kind of have the same feeling, sometimes the same message.
When you're working in a series, what kind of time frame are you involved with for each piece? Are you working fairly quickly, or are they very involved and then go on to the next one?
I'm an action painter. I can go through them pretty quickly. What I usually do is I'll prime 10 or 15 pieces because I like to prime my canvases yellow, which is kind of odd, but it's a trick that I learned. So I'll do that. I'll prime them all, and then I'll work on one piece, and then I'll go, why didn't I do that on this piece? And then, well, that leads to the next piece, and then so on and so on. So I've learned my lesson, to be honest with you. Rather than trying to recapture what I had going with that one piece, I now prepare 10, because I know I'm going to want to do 10 instead of just one. It's that simple, really. And, you know, it builds up. By the time I was 25, I probably had 3,500 paintings under my belt. That's a lot of thinking about painting, and it helps you to be able to judge further down the road. I used to say that, you know, let just your raw confidence build your ability, and then at some point your ability will continue to help your confidence. It's kind of a little loop there.
And when you finished a series of 25, 40, whatever it turns out to be, and you've come to that conclusion that you've exhausted that particular theme, what type of discrimination then do you use to go back through those? Do you discard? Do you reuse canvases? Are you just saying, I did it and I want to keep it?
When I was working in watercolors, I would keep them. I would hate to waste stuff. If I had a piece that I regarded as really terrible, what I would sometimes do is cut it up and see if I couldn't use elements of it to make a smaller piece. I don't like to waste materials. Watercolor is good watercolor, which I use Winsor & Newton, is very expensive. And,
right.
And although I don't make very many mistakes, I do. I'm human. You know, I've spilled stuff. I've mixed muddy colors, and I've just gone, what the heck? You know, so in that regard, I always try to save something. I have some over there on a table, just an example. There's always something that you can get from it. There's always going to be an element that, well, I like that part of it. I try to save that, if that makes any sense to you. Yeah.
Oh, it makes lots of sense. And sometimes there's just that element of, where can I physically keep all of these things? Do I need to keep all of them? And how best can I recycle if it has otherwise served its purpose? So,
I've made her cry before by throwing away art. I can sometimes be really, I'm throwing this stuff away. She said, why? You know, because I made it and I can't. I don't throw away in my paintings because I tend to work small, by the way, for people out there. I don't do these giant 8-foot canvases because if I did, I'd really be in trouble. So I work small, and as a result, they're relatively easy to store. And when I do have a bad canvas that I have painted, I don't have a problem at all about whitewashing that sucker and starting over. I don't really require this great inspiration, this sitting around and hoping and praying that I'm going to get a spark from heaven that creates me to paint. I wake up in the morning, I can paint. That's just the way it is. It's work to me. So when I make a mistake, I don't feel bad about just going, damn it, and just washing it off because, you know, that's the way it is.
I never consider the images that I create to be precious. And so I keep them around for 6 or 7 years and I get tired of looking at them and I paint over them. And I've had people come up to me and say, like, I really like that painting. I saw it about 10 years ago. And I went, yeah, it's under that one.
I've done that. I have actually given somebody a painting and say, you know, I'm actually giving you 4.
Yeah.
Here. And they're like, what? And they don't understand it. Well, there's like a duck under that. And then under that, I think there was a vase. And then I just spilled something.
Here I am sitting here working in materials that don't quite adapt that readily to the do-over. So maybe that's why photography has more recently become a fun thing, because the computer can fill up, but I'm not required to handle all of them or deal with them. But, you know, working in marble or working in silver, it tends to have a little bit more, here it is. So I envy sometimes that ability of just move on to something else and...
You work in a far more permanent medium than painting and drawing. And
well, it is permanent, but it also means that the exploration comes a little differently. Mm-hmm. And so I think I've come to understand myself more to know that the exploration often has to go into a whole different venue. Doing a remodel on the house says, oh, that's where my creativity is going at the moment. I'm not sitting in my metalsmithing studio. And I used to not understand that. And if I wasn't in the studio and I'd listen to people say, oh, I haven't been in my studio for 3 days and I'm going nuts. And I go, oh, I guess that means I'm not an artist because I haven't been in mine maybe for 3 months. And then I came to realize that that wasn't the equation. But it took a while to comprehend that one.
Well, sometimes Eric Clapton doesn't pick up his guitar for 3 weeks, you know, and it's Eric Clapton. So I understand that. You know, working in stone is a much slower process, and I think it's good because I think it'd be easy to make a mistake in stone if you don't really slow and easy, huh?
Is that
well,
the way it goes?
Yeah, it's definitely pretty much slow, sometimes easy, and definitely not a situation of, oh, well, I'll just sort of add this back on. Once it's on the floor, it's on the floor. But that's probably a big reason, and I haven't been a figurative artist hardly ever. But the idea of trying to, you know, replicate the human form and then realizing I just lost the nose is not something that has any appeal to me. So I work quite directly and often from almost no model at all, just letting the stone talk to me. So in some ways that is akin to some of the speed with which you're working and letting the materials at that moment direct before they dry up, and you can't squizzle it around. And oh, what a great word.
Squizzle?
Squizzle.
Squizzle.
Okay.
I think Snoop Dogg has come up with that one, actually.
Yeah, no, I don't think that it's new, but...
I have a book over there called Il Gigante that's about the stone that Michelangelo carved David from. Have you read that book?
No, unfortunately, I haven't.
Well, there's a remarkable story about when he was finished with it. He was showing it to a bunch of, I guess, dignitaries and cardinals or what have you, and one of them complained that the nose wasn't Roman enough or something like that. And Michelangelo palmed some marble dust and went up there and with a rasp and did this, and, you know, scraped it a little bit, releasing some of the marble dust as he did it, and he brushed it off and said, "How's that?" And where they all said, "That's much better," and he got down off the ladder. So he knows even that, you know, if you take too much off, you can't put it back.
That's right.
It's a wonderful story, by the way, and I'll loan you the book, but it's the stone that Leonardo da Vinci said couldn't be used. That's the legend, at least.
Well, having now been to this one quarry 9 times, actually more than that, I mean, it is so remarkable watching them get this stuff off the mountain. And then you look off the mountain and there's this hole in this other mountain. Well, that was one of Michelangelo's quarries, and there's a road, if you want to call it that, that comes down. And you're going, okay, how did they ever do that? I mean, the idea that you dug in and somehow then got it out, and then, you know, and I've seen pictures of the type of railing that they would use to put the stone on and then, you know, guide it down, and then you'd take the back part of the rail, the boards, and bring them to the front and make it again. It's like talking about a lot of work.
It was extremely dangerous work.
Still is.
Yes. Yes, and you know, Michelangelo was, by all means, supposed to be a pretty brawny guy, and you can imagine him doing that work.
Well, the quote that I've given even on this program, I'm sure before, but I love still having talked with the director of this quarry, and the interview went on, and then finally at the end I said, well, is there anything that we didn't talk about? He thought for a minute. And this is all in translation. I don't speak Italian, unfortunately. The answer that came back was, this marble gets sent all over the world, used for architecture, used for sculpture. And he pauses and he said, but we touch it first.
There you go.
And I saw him again this last summer, and it had been 8 or 9 years since that interview, but reminded him, and he smiled and said, uh-huh, even with Michelangelo, we touched it first.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Co-host Krista Hewitt and I would like to thank Rick Vainini for being our guest for today's program. We will continue our conversation with Rick and his wife Kathy next week when we discuss the upcoming release of a 3-volume set of images of Rick's collages titled The Cardboard Jungle, The Son of the Cardboard Jungle, and The Return of the Son of the Cardboard Jungle. Rick's website is www.rrvaginini.com, and Rick's Facebook page also contains images of his works. Our friends at Studios on the Park are sending out invitations to submit works for their only juried show for 2015. The show, titled Eat Your Heart Out, will run for the month of February. For information on the show, contact the curator and juror, Joe Thomas, at thomashillfarms@gmail.com, or contact the Studios on the Park. You have been tuned in to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas, produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio station KCBX in San Luis Obispo, California, on the Central Coast. Join us next week for more conversation with artist Rick Vainini. I am Stephen DeLuque, and for Krista Hewitt, thank you for your attention.